Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. In Chicago, for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. And let's take a look at how the markets wrapped up on Wall Street. Not much of a change on Friday from Thursday. Investors barely moved the needle, with the Dow down about 39.7 points, 0.17% at 23,422. The S&P 500 lost 2.3 points, 0.09%, to 2582, and the NASDAQ added nearly a point, 0.01%, to 6,751. For the week, the Dow was down 0.5%, the S&P 500 was down 0.21%, and the NASDAQ was down 0.2%. For the S&P and the Dow, this snapped 8 straight weeks of gains. For the NASDAQ, it snapped 6 straight weeks of gains. Among the big drags on the market on Friday, Intel and Apple. Going the other direction, though, a couple of record highs. Walmart hit a record high, as did Nvidia. Roku also had a big day, up 55% at one point, based on a strong earnings report, settling at 14% higher for the day. Disney had an interesting day, as shares were down over 2% as it missed on pretty much every metric possible. But then Bob Iger, the CEO and chairman, got on the earnings call and talked about the future and apparently painted such a rosy future that Disney ended up over 2%. Among other things, he said Disney would be going after Netflix in the streaming business, and Netflix shares were down over 2% in trading on Friday. Details of the dueling tax reform or tax cut plans issued by the House and the Senate also had a negative impact on the markets, as investors worried about the future of the promised corporate tax cuts following the plans unveiled by the House and by the Senate. Senate Republicans released their plan that differed from the version put out by the House on several key fronts, including putting off corporate tax cuts for another year. The expectations of lower taxes, one of the president's key campaign promises, have helped drive up the S&P 500 20% since the presidential election. We'll talk about tax reform with Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners coming up in just a few minutes. Checking commodities, let's begin with crops and critters. Chicago Board of Trade corn futures ended higher on Friday on short covering and technical buying after the December contract stayed above a contract low set a day earlier. December corn settled up 2 cents at 343.5 per bushel, holding above the contract low set Thursday at 340.75. For the week, the corn contract ended down 4.75 cents per bushel, about 1.4%, and that was the second straight weekly decline. Funds are holding a large net short position in the corn futures, leaving the market vulnerable to bouts of short covering. Traders continued to digest Thursday's USDA supply-demand reports, in which the government raised its estimate of the corn yield to a record high 175.4 bushels per acre. Soybean futures closed higher on Friday in a technical rebound from the prior session's steep declines and ended the week near unchanged. Gains on Friday were capped by fundamental pressure after the USDA on Thursday left its estimate of the 2017 soybean yield unchanged at 49.5 bushels per acre. Analysts had generally expected a reduction in that number. January soybeans settled at $9.87 a bushel on Friday, up 2 cents from Thursday when the contract posted its steepest percentage drop in 3.5 months. The January contract remained in a narrow range above Thursday's low and its 50-day moving average of around $9.83 and below its 20-day moving average of $9.90.75. December soy meal ended up $2.70 at $314.50 per short ton, and December soy oil fell 0.33 cents to $34.81 per pound. The export market also played a role, as the Chinese commodities trader COFCO International said it plans to double the volume of soybeans that it gets out of the Brazilian grains state of Mato Grosso during the next 5 years. Wheat futures closed higher on Friday on short covering and also some tie-in to the corn futures staying above the lows set a day earlier. December wheat settled up 2.5 cents at 431.5 a bushel. For the week, the contract rose 5.75 cents, or 1.4%, and that was the biggest weekly climb for wheat since mid-September. As for the critters, beef and pork were lower at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. October live cattle were off $1.90 at $120.57 a hundred. October feeder cattle fell 68 cents at $158.47 a hundred. And December lean hogs lost 70 cents at $62.47 a hundred. Crude oil was down slightly on Friday. Expectations of OPEC and other producers extending their production cut agreement were offset by U.S. drillers adding the most oil rigs in a week since June, indicating that output will continue to grow. Brent crude fell 38 cents, or 0.6%, at $63.55 a barrel. And West Texas Intermediate, the Texas T, fell 45 cents at $56.74 per barrel at the close. Both contracts were up about 2% for the week, the fifth week in a row of gains for the Brent and the West Texas. Part of what's going on involves Saudi Arabia's royal family. It is fairly complicated, and Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners will talk about that as well in just a few minutes. Gold futures were a little bit lower on Friday as U.S. Treasury bond yields rose, but losses were limited by weaker stock markets and also the dollar, which fell due to uncertainty over tax reform. A rise in bond yields pressured gold by reducing the attractiveness of non-yielding bullion, while a weaker dollar makes bullion cheaper for holders of other currencies. Spot gold was down 0.7% at $1,275.60 an ounce. Gold futures for December delivery settled down $13.30, 1%, at $1,274.20 per ounce. The dollar took its first weekly fall in a month as traders were disappointed that a tax overhaul may be delayed until 2019, and that put the brakes on the currency's recent rally. To help explain all of what happened on Wall Street and in the commodity markets this week, we will bring in Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners right after this.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need. Today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to the markets, sponsored by the CME Group. As I mentioned, welcome back to the markets, Steve. Welcome back to the markets, sponsored by the CME Group. Steve Alexander in Chicago for Orion Samuelson. As I mentioned, the equities rally took a pause this week. Let's bring in Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners in Chicago, a frequent contributor to the markets. And to what do we attribute the pause, Bob?
Well, there's a couple of things, but the main thing would be sort of the snag in tax reform. And snag's probably a strong word, but it's the way the market is taking it, so it's a word that I'm going to use. You got the initial tax reform package through the House. Then it went to the House Ways and Means Committee, got through there, and then it went over to the Senate, and the Senate put it in their Finance Committee for what they call the markup period. And in the markup period, which just sort of informally ended yesterday, it came out a lot different. So it certainly isn't earnings. It isn't interest rates because they're not really doing much. We didn't have a lot of data this week. So overall, you're talking about with a really strong energy sector and your energy prices in general generally leads to a strong energy sector. The only thing to point to this sort of pause is to this hiccup in tax reform where the Senate and House plans look so different on key points.
I've heard more than one opinion that the equities are overbought based in large part on the expectation that there would be this corporate tax break. Do you agree with that? And I suppose that's what you're speaking to.
Well, no, I don't think you can relate the two, and it is. They can't be overbought if the tax break happens. So, you know, they're overbought if the tax break doesn't happen, and that's simply because these particular corporations won't have this excess money coming in, or rather staying in, I should say. The main issue with the Senate part of the bill that the market is taking issue with is during the Senate markup, they're pushing back corporate tax cuts a year to 2019. So the move from the 35% base rate to 20% would happen in 2019, not virtually immediately as it would in the House bill. And this is one of the Senate's ways of staying within that $1.5 trillion increase in the deficit that allows them to pass the bill through reconciliation, which means 51 votes instead of 60. If they exceed this $1.5 trillion number in the sort of accounting of the bill, then it goes to the 60 vote. It doesn't get through with reconciliation. So that's the issue. If you push it back to 2019, according to the Senate math, it then works. They also left the estate tax not untouched, but they didn't. The House bill destroyed the estate tax, and the Senate bill did not. The Senate bill left the majority of the estate tax in. They both have the deductibility of state income tax removed, so that particular part wasn't touched at all, which is what some people speculated would be touched. It's the corporate part that hit the equity markets.
Some people are concerned about the amount that they say this bill would add to the deficit. Does that concern you?
Not if they stay within that $1.5 trillion, because it probably would have been about $1.3 trillion if nothing was done. People forget that the deficit goes up every year. So when you talk about $1.5 trillion, the amounts that the deficits have gone up, you know, again, it went up during President Obama's two terms higher than it did compared to all the other presidents combined. Now, there's some unfairness when people say that as a negative, simply because of the economy he was handed, number one. Number two, you can't compare to, you put George Washington's deficit in there, it's pennies. So it's not really fair, but our deficits have continued to rise throughout presidencies until you get back to President Clinton. The 90s is what a lot of people point to when they say that if you get economic growth, you can get balanced budgets, and that was true for the 90s. However, that was a bit of a bubble, and there was bipartisan legislation and tax reform that was done then, and it just seems like bipartisanship is dead right now, so there's not much hope of that.
Let's take a look at oil prices. We had all this activity with the Saudi royal family that I don't understand, and I hope you can help straighten that out. And also, what impact that, if any, is going to have on crude oil futures as well as prices eventually at the pump?
Yes, so the media has been whimsically calling this the Saudi purge, but there's really nothing whimsical about it. The Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who replaced his older cousin a couple of years ago as the Crown Prince, was put in charge of an anti-corruption probe, and he essentially had about 201 so far Saudi princes and business leaders detained. Now, they've been detained in the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, which is not the worst detention center I've ever heard of, but it's still a detention. They got their personal assets seized to the tune of $33 billion U.S. dollars, and there's no real charges yet. There's been sort of numbers thrown about $100 billion U.S. dollars having been embezzled by various members of these people who've been detained. That's a serious charge. Now, it's being seen as a consolidation of power by the crown prince. Now, Saudi Arabia, for the last, since 1932, has basically been ruled by consensus of the many thousands of princes and influential business leaders that they are. The king goes around, tries to get a consensus, and whoever doesn't really agree with whatever the plans of the king are kind of gets paid off and becomes part of the plan. Well, the crown prince is a reformer. There's also been rumors that King Salman is going to step down and abdicate the throne and hand it to the crown prince sooner than the people of Saudi Arabia know about. But he's very popular with the youth of Saudi Arabia, the so-called millennials, which make up close to 70% of the population. He's almost single-handedly responsible for women being allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. He's also a proponent of women being able to go out in public without their hair covered. He's a reformer, and he has enemies. He's basically rounded those enemies up. Now, what does that have to do with oil prices? Well, he's also an Iran hawk. He is not a fan of the Iranian regime and the increased Iranian sort of effect in the region and their influence in the region. Neither, obviously, is the Trump administration, and you've seen a little bit of a bromance between the Saudi royal family and President Donald Trump over the last couple of visits. So there's a lot of sort of, I don't want to call them conspiracy theories, because there's actually things going on. For example, the crown prince is in charge of the war in Yemen, which is viewed as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So the Iranian part of this is what has oil prices higher. There has been no effect on supply and demand at this point. But remember, Iran produces over 2 million barrels a day, Saudi Arabia over 11 million barrels a day. If the two of them end up in an actual war, now you have an effect on the supply chain, and that's why prices are higher now.
I don't have a graph in front of me, but as I recall, the oil futures have been kind of in the 40s and the low 50s for quite a while. Is that a product of the global glut that I hear about?
Yeah, for a long time, and we were lower than that. We hit $26 or $27. I think it was $26.40 approximately. Don't quote me on that, but the low was in the mid-20s. There was an overabundance of supply versus demand. We had slower global economies and a huge output from U.S. shale. The United States is now the third largest producer, and we're not off of second place. We're at about 9.5 million barrels a day now. Russia's around 10. Our record for our history is about 9.5 million barrels a day, so we're going to end up beating the record this year. So the U.S. has really become the marginal producer of crude oil, and as we produce more, there's a supply glut. Because, you know, prior to that, we spent the last 10 years or so producing about 3-4 million barrels. So almost tripling the production of a major economy like this. This also is going to affect things. Now, one more thing about the Saudi Crown Prince, he's also a proponent of extending the production cut that OPEC did about 18 months ago. Or, I'm sorry, about a year ago. They enacted a production cut. When asked about it in a Bloomberg interview, the Crown Prince said, of course, I want to extend the production cuts. Vladimir Putin basically said the same thing about a month ago. So the two of them together, it's almost assured the production cut is going to be extended. So you take that Saudi supply out. Currently, U.S. supply is leaning toward the downside. It's going to swing down a little bit. We've had a reduction of rig counts over, the say, 13 of the last 16 weeks. But if prices stay elevated like they are now versus the 40s that you mentioned, the U.S. shale producers now can make money again. So they'll go to the CME group, hedge their futures at a higher price, and go ahead and produce. And that will eventually bring prices down again. Right now, you're going to see a little bit of a spike at the pump, but it's almost worth holding that off because when the shale producers get going, they tend to roll downhill pretty quickly, and that'll bring prices down for the longer term.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what that price level is that at which the shale producers don't make money.
Well, they don't make money for the most. It's difficult to sort of generalize like that because there's different basins. There's the Permian Basin, the Eagle Ford, and they all have different break-evens. But if you put it around $40, and we're below $40, the vast majority of them lose money. When we're above $40, we're getting closer. At $60, the vast majority of them can make a little bit of money, including hedging their risk at the CME with the forward curve, which I know is a little bit complicated, but it's really not as complex as it sounds. Yeah. So when you see prices going up like this, it just means the U.S. producers are going to come online. Now, people think they just turn the spigots on. They don't. It's not like a faucet. They don't just go turn the wells back on. It takes time to ramp up. So we're probably going to suffer a little bit, but they could be ramped up by the time we reach the summer driving season, which would be a good thing.
Speaking of making money, you know, I've ignored Bitcoin for a long time because, A, I really don't understand it, and B, as recently as October, somebody that is, has as much prestige as Jamie Dimon said that anybody who invests in Bitcoin is stupid, so I've ignored it. But now, CME Group, Terry Duffy had said that they were going to engage in the trading of futures of Bitcoin?
Yes, it would be Bitcoin futures based off of a Bitcoin index that the CME actually launched, which doesn't need approval because it just tracks the price of Bitcoin. They launched a Bitcoin index last year in November 2016. So that's been sort of tracking Bitcoin for about a year now, and the CME is going to go to the regulators with a Bitcoin contract. They've released the specs. They've released the limit up and limit down limits already. You can find that at the CME Group's website.
But before you drill down too deeply here, Bob, let's tell me what Bitcoin really is. And I understand it's in a group called cryptocurrency, but that doesn't help me out too much. So what exactly is it?
Crypto is simply a fun name for digital. It's a digital currency is what it is. It's a currency that exists sort of in the ether, in the internet. And essentially, when you're talking about cryptocurrencies, you're talking about a currency that is not controlled by a government or banks. That's why when you say somebody who has prestige like Jamie Dimon, it's also somebody who has the most to lose like Jamie Dimon. If Bitcoin were to become widely adopted, you can now transfer money to me, or I can transfer money to you, or any company can transfer money to you or to another company without a bank involved. It's just a direct transaction.
Right.
And those transactions are not verified by a bank. They're verified by technology called blockchain, which now we would be getting into things that we probably don't have time for.
No, but what is backing this? What currency or what treasury? Or how do we know that this is real money and not a scam?
Well, it's kind of funny because you pay for blockchain with U.S. dollars or euros or any other currency you have. But quite frankly, as long as someone else is accepting it, it's not a scam. In other words, let's say that, you know, you have a plumber that comes over, and this plumber says, I'm going to fix your toilet in exchange for that, Steve. I'd like to be on your radio show. Well, you've just transacted in a currency.
Right.
Right? As long as someone will accept Bitcoin, Bitcoin is a currency. There's nothing that needs to back it. So, for example, Subway accepts Bitcoin. You can go into a Subway sandwich shop and pay for your sandwich in Bitcoin. There's no scam there.
Well, who sets
the
price?
You give them Bitcoin, they give you a sandwich. Well, the price is set by the market. So here's the other thing about Bitcoin. There is a limited number of Bitcoin that can ever exist. It's built into the technology. So there's no government that can ever print Bitcoin like U.S. dollar has been printed, like euro, like Japanese yen have been printed by the governments that run those. No government can ever print Bitcoin and lower the value of it. So the value is simply set by the people who are transacting in it. The more acceptance you get by vendors for Bitcoin, the less likely it is to ever go away. So it's not. It's only a scam if all of a sudden, it's never really a scam. Bitcoin at this point can no longer be called a scam. It's an actual thing that exists. It actually has technology behind it. You can't hold it in your hand, but you also can't hold your email account in your hand. You can't hold your email, but you know it's a thing. Same thing with cryptocurrencies. They exist in technology, online, and they're transactable.
Who's making up the rules on Bitcoin, and how do we know that they're not going to change the rules at some point, which will, you know, make whatever amount of Bitcoin that I have no longer worth as much as it is?
That's a great question. So the rules were made at the initiation of Bitcoin, but there have been what's called hard forks, which means that some of the people involved in the mining of Bitcoin, or not the mining of Bitcoin, but the managing of the Bitcoin ledgers have said, we want to do it this way. So they've broken off into two currencies. That has happened. However, if you think about it, when you say, how do I know that they won't change it and my Bitcoin will be worth less, that's what's happened with the U.S. dollar. The Federal Reserve changed the rules by doing quantitative easing, and the value of your U.S. dollars dropped. So this is not something that's unusual. This is something that happens to us every day in our U.S. dollars, and people holding euro and people holding Japanese yen. Government changes the rules, and your yen or your euro or your U.S. dollar become worth more or less based on those rule changes. It happens all the time. So it's not something that's unusual.
Yeah, it's a leap of faith that I don't know that I can make. It's a brave new world, and I'm not sure that I'm equipped to be dabbling in this.
Well, again, that's obviously people's choices. But if you think about all of the complaints about a cryptocurrency, everything that everyone complains about happens in U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
And we accept it simply because the government accepts payment of our taxes in U.S. dollars. That's the only thing that gives U.S. dollar its value.
Excuse me. Is there an organization that regulates all of this?
No, there's not. The Internet regulates it. And again, this worries people, right? They say, Well, how is it regulated? Well, the U.S. government, the U.S. Federal Reserve essentially regulates U.S. dollars. And the value of your U.S. dollar has fluctuated over the last 10 years like we've never seen in history.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what that regulation is necessarily worth. I don't have an opinion on what the Federal Reserve should do that I would talk about publicly. However, right now you can buy gift cards with Bitcoin that go to about 50,000 different vendors, from McDonald's to The Gap to just regular stores. So if you have Bitcoin, you can go buy a gift card, and you can go use, and essentially you've bought something with Bitcoin. Now, the big risk to cryptocurrencies, and this will be a reality at some day, they're already doing it. A story came out this morning. The transactions in cryptocurrencies right now, the government doesn't get a piece of that. They don't get tax revenue on it. That will change.
Mm-hmm.
And if someday the government says, it's now illegal to accept Bitcoin because we can't track it for tax purposes, Bitcoin will go from 7,000 to very, very much lower than that. But people in developing markets like Venezuela and places like that experience that with their own currency every day, and that currency is backed by their government.
At this point, why would I buy, or why would anybody, if the dollar or wherever they are, the dollar, the euro, the yen, are available, why would they invest in and use Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency?
Well, you have to have a couple of core beliefs. Like, for example, Bitcoin has gone up 500% this year. The U.S. dollar is not. So somebody might do that because they actually want to take advantage of something they believe will continue to increase in value. Now, currently, our U.S. Fed is in the process of removing quantitative easing and raising interest rates, so the value of the dollar has gone up. But that is a very real thing in people's lives. And because we go about our day-to-day lives, most people spend dollars in the U.S. and they don't feel any difference. When prices in something go up, it's because the value of the currency you're buying in it has gone down. That's essentially all inflation is. People think that somebody came in and raised prices so they can make more money, but that isn't necessarily it. Somebody's buying Scottish salmon, and the power of the dollar has gone down, so the salmon is more expensive now in dollars because the dollar is weaker. It's a little complicated, but it actually affects people every single day. Somebody might go into cryptocurrencies and say, well, I don't trust the U.S. government's management of my dollars, so I would rather go into this, which has no government involvement. That's why somebody would do it. Not necessarily why I'm involved. I'm involved from a trading perspective only. We don't buy and hold any cryptocurrencies personally.
Right.
But as an asset class, it's a real thing, and the CME is actually getting involved because it's a real thing, and they're going to help validate it.
Coincidentally, I got an email last night, the headline, Buy Bitcoin Using Your IRA or 401k.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. Okay.
No, nobody should do that. We're not at that point. Again, look, when a major government comes in and says, we are not getting tax revenue, and that's true. People evade taxes with cryptocurrencies, and that's not right. Mm-hmm. It's against the law and shouldn't be done. But people are able to do it because the government can't track them. There's other cryptocurrencies that are even more confidential than Bitcoin is. So at some point, governments will come in and figure out a way to reach for what is theoretically, it's legally their fair share of it. And when that happens, the values will change dramatically. So there's a lot of unknowns there. But it's not going away. Cryptocurrencies are not going away. This will be a way that people transact 10 to 20 years from now with no government involvement. No direct government involvement.
One more thing about taxes, and you just mentioned paying taxes. At least earlier in the week, Paul Ryan was saying that everybody is going to get a tax cut out of the House bill. The Senate version may be different, but is it possible for everybody to get a tax cut?
No, it really isn't. Okay. I guess when it comes to tax policy, the thing that bothers me the most is when politicians and the media say we have to pay for the tax cut. And they never, never discuss cutting spending. It's never even in the conversation anymore. No, it's not possible for everyone to get a tax cut because you simply can't cut everyone's taxes and have it be revenue neutral. And revenue neutral is the big buzz phrase that everybody is using. So, no, it's not possible in its current sense unless they're going to cut spending, and they've shown no appetite for that at all.
Do you think they will get a tax reform package passed this year?
I do. I just don't think it will be. It won't have much teeth to it. I think the corporate tax part will get passed in some way, shape, or form. But earnings have been good. So if there's a dip after the tax reform bill is passed, you should probably buy that dip.
Two questions before I let you go. One is, any surprises this week? And then B, next week, anything you're looking forward to?
Next week, we start getting some more economic data again in terms of pricing and retail sales and things. So I'll be looking at that. The earnings season has wound down. It's been very, very strong. The two things I'll be looking at the most is that economic data. We had very little this week. We only really had University of Michigan consumer sentiment, which came in a little bit lower. But I'll be looking at the pricing data, the retail sales data, and then also at the developments with Saudi Arabia and where this goes. No official charges have been filed, so we really don't have enough information on that yet.
Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners, I appreciate the education on Bitcoin and also the Saudi royal family's problems. Where can people get a hold of you, hear you, interact with you, all of that?
They can follow me on Twitter, which is Bob_Iacino. We also have a podcast we do every week, which comes out on Saturday afternoon. You can find that by typing the Money Path podcast into either iTunes or Google Play. And also PathTradingPartners.com. There's a support email there, support email button you can just hit, and that'll eventually get to me.
Bob Iacino, Path Trading Partners. Thank you very much.
Good to be here, Steve.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
One more time for the week. The Dow was down 0.5%, the S&P 500 down 0.21%, and the NASDAQ was down 0.2%, a flat week. That's The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. In Chicago, for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander.